In this sense, we started to be involved with this house and part of the Active Earth Bolivia movement, and to initiate actions around the COP and the People's Summit.
Voices from the Tierra Activa Convergence Space here in Lima, Peru. Tune in tomorrow for coverage of today's climate march. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable crew. Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aramate, Nirmi Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Ravi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Dennis Moynihan, Clara Ibarra, Andres Contreras, John Hamilton, and Chuck Skurich. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Wednesday evening news from KBOO coming up next. And the script KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available from all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Hi, this is Justin Miller, KBOO's underwriting coordinator. Every day, local businesses support KBOO through program sponsorship or underwriting. These underwriters are people like you, progressive, diverse, and supporting real radio. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and telling them that you heard about them on KBOO. If your business would like to reach out to the area's 55,000 most diverse and progressive listeners, you can learn how at kboo.fm/underwriting. By email to underwriting@kboo.org, or call Justin 503-231-8032. KBOO Underwriting. Your clients are listening.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, the membership coordinator at KBOO Community Radio. I just want to take a moment to say thank you to all the people that made our 3-day December drive a rousing success. From our volunteers that answered phones, created great programs, and engineered live music, and to all of our listeners that called in or donated online, and to the restaurants that donated food for our volunteers. I would also like to thank and welcome the 40-plus new members to the KBOO community. Without your support, KBOO would not be what it is today. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council considers body cameras for police.
The Oregon State Land Board is again considering the sale of the Elliott State Forest.
And we get an update from KBOO reporter Yana Maximova, who's in Peru, covering the People's Climate Summit in Lima.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 10th, 2014. I'm Eric Tegadoff.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The Portland City Council today discussed a plan to issue body cameras to police bureau members. While the discussion was intended to focus on exploring options in the market, the conversation revolved around privacy issues, issues of accountability, and discretion by police officers when taping was appropriate.
Okay, item 1276.
Okay.
Authorize a competitive solicitation for an on-body camera system for police officers.
Thanks. I'm going to call up Lieutenant John Scruggs to talk about this item. We think that we should probably do a few community public forums. That's what we envision doing in the coming year. We're also meeting with the district attorney's office and a lot of other IPR. There's a lot of different parties involved in this. And then taking some of those ideas and incorporating our policy. And as you know, the Portland Police Bureau actually puts our policies online before we implement them, and there's also the ability for the community to give input at that time as well.
So I would suggest, Mayor, that a more formal process, potentially with a task force that would work on this, might be more appropriate in this particular case.
We think that on-body cameras,
transparency, police transparency, will intersect with privacy. And so we have to adapt rules that allow us to turn it off. If you're interviewing somebody who's a victim of a sexual assault, you probably don't want that on camera. If you're taking a child abuse call or you're in a hospital, there's times when you're going to want officers to be able to turn these things off. So you're going to want a policy that ensures that it's on the majority of the time on calls for service. But at the same time, you want to allow some flexibility so that these personal conversations that may be recorded or places where you don't want a camera, that the officer has the ability to turn it off.
And Mayor, we may have to do something at the legislature, because I know that with 911 calls, they are a public record. And so since you don't have the opportunity to ask the person if they're willing to be recorded while you're maybe going there.
Michael Alexander, President and CEO of the Urban League of Portland. Hands up, don't shoot. I can't breathe. Black Lives Matter. Each of these phrases has taken on tremendous significance over the past few months and ignited a new resolve to address the ongoing concerns regarding police accountability and the use of force. Correcting the problems that the city and the Bureau face here will not be addressed by a single initiative or practice. Simple answers to complex problems always result in an exacerbation of the problem that it sought to correct. The Urban League believes that the use of body cameras is one of the best opportunities available to citizens and officers for objective recording of an incident. We also believe that it has the potential to modify the behavior of all parties. The Urban League believes that if implemented within a strong policy and practice framework, the use of this technology can be utilized in a manner that does not create unmanageable risk to personal privacy.
I'm King Bishop Stiles, representing the Three Kings of Portland. So I really appreciate Commissioner Saltzman and Commissioner Fish on just like your veracity in attacking legislation on this particular issue and procedure. My personal mission is to bridge the gap in between the community and the law enforcement in order to bridge the gap of untrust that's going on right now. And I really would like to start with saying I know that it's a hard issue as far as the body cams are concerned, especially due to the recent happenings with Eric Garner. And as of about 6 weeks ago, my personal profiling in Southwest Portland, due to the presentations that I give through the ACLU on rights with police, I was able to have a good interaction. But using my camera on my phone, it was just obvious, you know, right away. The police officer covered up his name tags, did not want to be filmed. So that is something that's alarming for me in looking into money being spent on cameras and being legitimately accountable for actions. And I just wonder if money would be better spent in real accountability as far as training and the ability to be able to realistically engage with the community in conversations and building relationship to have that true transparency. Because like I said, you know, just in my personal encounter, there wasn't any transparency. There wasn't any accountability. The police officer recognized that I had knowledge and I used it and did everything that he possibly could to not be recognized.
Those were excerpts from today's Portland City Council meeting regarding the first steps towards issuing police body cameras. The voices you heard were Portland Mayor Charlie Hales, Commissioner Amanda Fritz, Portland Bureau Lieutenant John Scruggs, Michael Alexander of the Urban League of Portland, and King Bishop Stiles of the Three Kings of Portland.
Under pressure from business groups, the Portland City Council has released a new street fund proposal that would charge small businesses with less money. The plan would exempt home businesses making less than $50,000 from the new tax and decrease charges for other businesses. The street fund would provide funding to add new sidewalks, improve street pavement, and improve safety at intersections, particularly on Portland's underserved east side. Commissioner Steve Novick initially proposed a flat tax, which would have disproportionately burdened the poor. The city has wrangled with citizens and business groups for months over the plan. The previous version of the plan was a graduated tax that split the cost evenly between businesses and residents. The current plan reduces business expenses by $2 million, which, while leaving city expenses the same.
The rideshare company Uber has recently begun operating illegally in Portland, and a lawsuit addressing the issue has reached a federal court. Uber's main critique of the city is that its taxi laws are outdated, and their operations have been an effort to change that. Uber drivers have continued to operate despite the threat of ticketing and vehicle impounding from the city. City Commissioner Steve Novick would not comment on Uber or the current taxi laws, and the city attorney has advised all members of City Council not to comment on the issue until the lawsuit is settled.
Protesters in Berkeley, California, again blocked highways last night to bring attention to the issue of police violence and to call for justice for the recent victims of police shootings. The protesters were frustrated that the Berkeley, California City Council canceled a meeting on the topic. So they gathered near City Hall, then marched through Berkeley last night for a fourth straight night. The protesters then defied California Highway Patrol vows to block them from freeways by briefly shutting down nearby Highway 24, the San Francisco Chronicle reported. Demonstrators passed by the phalanxes of police blocking them. Then dozens of protesters ripped a fence down and dashed onto the westbound lanes of the freeway near a rapid transit station. Cars screeched to a halt as Highway Patrol officers moved in and fired smoke projectiles and beanbags at the crowd. All traffic on the highway ceased. Many demonstrators yelled, "Hands up, don't shoot," with their hands raised in the familiar pose of protesters over the past couple of months. Some threw loud fireworks. 13 protesters were arrested, and the freeway was cleared in about 10 minutes. There are now over 200 people in jail in the San Francisco Bay Area from the protest against police brutality over the last few days.
Meanwhile, in London, protesters shut down a mall today with a massive die-in against police brutality in the United States. Protests chanted slogans like "We can't breathe" and lay down on the ground as if they were dead, eventually shutting down the popular mall. Protesters then got up, raised their hands as if they were being escorted by the police, and blocked a major road in downtown London. The police there surrounded dozens of the protesters, accusing them of violent disorder, and arrested them. Protests against grand jury decisions in the Michael Brown and Eric Garner cases are still taking place in the United States as well.
The state of Oregon has completed a recount of a ballot measure to require labels on all food containing genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. The measure came within 800 votes of passing, but the Secretary of State's office officially announced on Wednesday morning that the measure had been defeated. Proponents of GMO labeling, however, say they will not give up the fight. KBOO's Janka Soderberg has more.
The defeat of Measure 92, an Oregon ballot initiative to mandate the labeling of food containing genetically modified organisms, was made official this week with the certification of the ballot recount. Proponents of the measure filed a last-minute lawsuit on Monday to reconsider 4,500 contested ballots, but an Oregon judge dismissed it the following day. Oregon is a state without polling stations, where voters send ballots by mail to election offices in sealed and signed envelopes. Ballots are subject to challenge if the voter forgets to sign the envelope or if the signature differs from the one on record. In such cases, voters have 3 weeks to verify their ballots. More ballots were challenged this year than on average, and when the Oregon Secretary of State's office made the list of challenged voters public, supporters of Measure 92 went door to door to ask those voters to go into the election office to make sure their ballots were counted. These canvassers said they began to notice a pattern.
If you look at the list of ballots that have been challenged statewide, you will find that the majority of them are from Portland, and the majority of them are for signatures that do not match. So I've had some questions about that. And the reason I say that is because Multnomah County is a reservoir of liberal and left votes. And I find it less than credible that thousands of Multnomah County voters don't know how to sign their ballots.
Some supporters of Measure 92, like Teresa Mitchell, suspected opponents of the measure were deliberately challenging voters to ensure defeat for the GMO labeling initiative.
Here's the thing with challenged ballots. Groups like True the Vote or other bunches associated with Karl Rove and conservative groups will train people to do what they call citizen vote monitoring, which is legally available to all citizens, especially available if you can get in on the county commission. to count the ballots as an official. But the secret trick is they challenge the registration or the signature or whatever of ballots that they know are coming from a progressive area or a progressive population, or they challenge ballots with black or Hispanic seeming names in order to throw the election to conservative whites who will fall in line with billionaires and corporations like Monsanto.
The lawsuit filed this week by supporters of GMO labeling did not claim that there was a deliberate attempt by the opposition to have thousands of votes challenged, but did ask for the challenged votes to be counted. A judge dismissed the lawsuit, but supporters of the measure say they are considering an appeal. This is the second legal challenge filed by Measure 92 supporters during the recount process. The first, filed on December 2nd, claimed that the opponents of the measure hired people from out of state to act as observers in the recount. Tony Green from the Oregon Secretary of State's office explains how a recount works in Oregon.
Counties do it, and it's a hand count as opposed to a machine count. So you'll have people looking over each ballot and determining how the ballot, whether it's a yes, no, or whether they didn't cast, they didn't pick either one. A member of both the pro and the anti measure. Campaigns are entitled to observe the counting in each county.
The observers sent by the supporters and opponents of the measure must, by law, be Oregon residents. But in this case, supporters of GMO labeling, like John DeAndrati, said some of those standing in as recount observers for the No on 92 side came from out of state.
They brought in out-of-state people to help defeat, to challenge ballots in this process. And the Yes campaign actually said, hey, you can't do that. That's actually not legal. But it was up to the Yes campaign to actually say, you can't be doing that. That doesn't cut it.
Even before the lawsuits, the GMO labeling ballot measure has been the most expensive in Oregon history, with over $21 million raised by the opposition, with all but 1,000 of those dollars coming from out of state. Several weeks before the election, a multi-million dollar ad campaign targeted television viewers featuring Oregon farmers.
Measure 92's complex Oregon-only food labeling scheme would unfairly hurt Oregon farmers. It would also increase grocery costs for Oregon consumers and give them misleading information about foods they buy. Please join family farmers and vote no.
Many Oregon family farmers, in fact, have been leading the campaign to label GMOs, particularly in southern Oregon, where two rural counties have banned GMO crop production altogether in a bid to prevent genetic contamination of organic crops. Data from the Oregon Secretary of State shows the biggest funders of the No on 92 coalition were the biotech seed giants DuPont, Pioneer, and Monsanto. Soda giants Coca-Cola and Pepsi also contributed heavily, as did processed food companies. Former Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich came to Oregon to support the GMO labeling bill and challenged the assertion that it would cost the companies in the state of Oregon any additional money to implement.
Look, they're already printing labels with ingredients. So if you're already printing labels with ingredients, you just put on there genetically engineered, extra printing. No real cost at all. They're claiming that, well, they'd have to substitute everything, GMOs with organics. I mean, all their assumptions were wrong. It's a negligible cost. Consumer Union, which is a nonpartisan group, said so.
The measure was defeated by a razor-thin margin of just over 800 votes out of over 1.5 million votes cast. And while the recount confirms the measure's defeat, supporters of labeling say the battle is not over. In addition to appealing the dismissal of their lawsuit demanding that all challenged ballots be counted, the Oregon Right to Know campaign is already planning their signature-gathering plan to put another measure to label genetically modified organisms on the ballot in the 2016 election. For FSRN, I'm Jenka Soderberg in Portland, Oregon.
The fate of a state forest in the Central Coast Range has again sparked controversy as the Oregon State Land Board is considering the sale of the Elliott State Forest in Coos Bay. The board, comprised of Governor John Kitzhaber, Secretary of State Kate Brown, and Treasurer Ted Wheeler, is determining a range of options in order to sell the forest either to private timber companies or to a public entity. Historically, the forest has contributed to the state's Common School Fund, a provision that is part of the Oregon State Constitution. The board is looking to divest itself of the forest as a 2013 lawsuit to prevent logging has dried up revenue that the forest once contributed. Its options include private sale, selling the forest to a different state agency, selling the forest to federal or tribal governments, or selling the forest while designating some portion as a public parkland. KBOO's Mike Klepfer spoke with Cordelia Finley of Cascadia Forest Defenders, a group opposed to logging in the forest.
To start with, can you talk about the Elliott State Forest and its importance as an ecosystem?
So the Elliott State Forest is a piece of property just north of Coos Bay, Oregon, and south of Reedsport, Oregon. It's about, of the 93,000 acres that comprise the whole forest, about 40,000 of those contain trees that are over 100 years old, which have never been logged before. Most people consider that old growth. And the forest is habitat to the marbled murrelet, which is a threatened seabird, and the northern spotted owl. The Elliott contains about 2% of the state's watersheds, but accounts for streams in the Elliott contribute 20% of Oregon's coastal coho salmon population, and the coastal coho salmon is also a threatened species. So it's really essential for all three of those species, and also contains more old growth than any other piece of public forest in the state.
Currently, the Elliott funds state education via the Common School Fund. Can you talk about the Common School Fund and the Elliott's role in funding education?
Yeah. Right now, the Elliott is owned by the Common School Fund and managed by the Oregon Department of Forestry with the intention that timber harvest revenues generated in the Elliott will contribute to the Common School Fund. Because of federal protections attached to the marbled murrelet and other threatened species in the Elliott, timber harvest and the Elliott has been very low in the last few years. The land board's realizing that the Elliott can't really be relied on to fund the Common School Fund using their current plan, because that would require illegal logging. That would require, like, timber harvest practices that would violate federal law and cause them to get sued and lose money instead of making it. The Elliott in the last few years has generated less than a percentage of the Common School Fund's total, less than 1%. So the Elliott contributes almost nothing to the Common School Fund. And I think that that's kind of symptomatic of this need for public education to be supported by something other than timber harvest revenues.
So what actions are currently underway to protect the Elliott State Forest, and how would you suggest people learn more, get more involved?
Well, Cascadia Wildlands, which is a conservation law group, has filed a lawsuit, and that's ongoing. The lawsuit that Cascadia Wildlands filed has great potential in terms of legally protecting the three parcels of land in the Elliott that have already been privatized, and that privatization happened earlier this year. The lawsuit concerned marbled murrelet. There are motions by conservation law groups like Cascadia Wildlands to legally protect parts of the Elliott. There are other groups that collect data about Elliott ecosystems, including Coast Range Forest Watch, which is a citizen science group that collects data about marbled murrelet. The final thing that folks who are worried about the Elliott are doing is the kind of work that Cascadia Forest Defenders does, which is direct action to confront politicians about the Elliott State Forest and things that they could do to invest in Oregon's future and not destroy the last of its old growth. And there are a number of activist groups who participate in anything from marches in cities to hikes in the forest to, if it came down to it, tree sits to stop logging operations. And anyone who wanted to get more involved in helping the Elliott could seek more information about any of those things.
Cordelia Finley, I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This is Mike Klepper with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a report back from Gaza with Ned Rosch and Maxine Fuchsen, two Portland residents who just returned from a trip to the Gaza Strip. This will be followed by Right to Survive Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Rock Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 55 and a low of 44. A high wind advisory is in effect tomorrow, as well with south to southeast winds from 25 to 35 miles per hour, with gusts up to 65 miles per hour. Today in history, in 1884, Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is published. In 1907, 1,000 London medical students, enraged over a memorial to vivisected animals erected by the fledgling animal rights movement, clashed with police in what would be known as the Brown Dog Riots. In 1948, the United Nations adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, of which the United States ratified. Today is known as International Human Rights Day. The quote of the day is from Ronald Reagan, from his signing statement on the UN Convention Against Torture, which he signed in 1984. "Ratification of the convention by the United States will clearly express United States' opposition to torture, an abhorrent practice unfortunately still prevalent in the world today."
A report was released yesterday outlining CIA actions during the Bush administration, specifically the enhanced interrogation techniques used, commonly referred to as torture. The report signifies that while ineffective in procuring accurate information, these techniques were used from 2002 to 2008. Vice President Dick Cheney was briefed of these procedures in 2003. However, it was revealed through these documents that former President George W. Bush was not made aware of these actions until late 2004. Despite being heavily redacted, the report contains a massive amount of newly declassified information that sheds light on the events leading to our invasion of Iraq. News correspondent Riley Turner interviewed Sam Husseini, communications director for the Institute for Public Accuracy, for more detail on the subject.
Torture has been proven ineffective at producing accurate information. With this in mind, why did the CIA continue to use what they call enhanced interrogation techniques throughout the Bush-Cheney presidency? Did it truly take 8 years to discover that these techniques weren't working?
Well, there's an increasing body of evidence that they knew from the get-go that it wasn't going to produce true information. So why'd they do it? I think that there's so much is obscured and confidential. It's still redacted and censored. That we, you know, it's hard to know for certain, but there's an increasing body of evidence that they did it because they wanted to produce false but useful information. That is, information that would help justify policies that they wanted to do. The classic example of this, which is a footnote, it's footnote 857 in the report that was just made public, is the story of Shengel Libby. This is somebody who the U.S. turned over to the Egyptian dictatorship in before the Iraq War. They captured him in Afghanistan. He told them all he knew when he was interrogated by the FBI in Afghanistan. They turned him over to the Egyptians, who tortured him into saying that Iraq was cooperating with al-Qaeda. This ended up being used by Colin Powell in his speech in front of the UN, his war speech to the UN. So, in a sense, torture works very well at producing false but useful information, that is, information that can be used as a pretext to policies that you want to have happen.
Is there anything to be learned from the timing of the release of this report? Could the timing be a strategic political play by the Obama administration?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's highly suspect. This report was delayed for a very long time. You know, it now comes after the election with the Republicans, you know, taking more control over Congress. So the Democrats can sort of wash their hands of it and say, oh, well, the Republicans are in charge now. We can't do anything after that. The Obama administration and, you know, Senator Feinstein, to a large extent, acquiesced and, you know, waited so long and agreed with so much redacting that the CIA insisted on. I mean, but what we now have is the part of the executive summary, much of which is blacked out. So we're getting maybe 20% of this actual report, which itself was rather neutered. That is, this report was based on documents that already existed. They didn't actually do any interviews to produce this report.
That was Sam Husseini, Communications Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. For KBOO News, this is Riley Turner.
A provision in the emergency government spending bill threatens to completely gut the bank regulations put into place after the 2008 financial meltdown. The so-called Cromnibus Bill, or an omnibus on a continuing resolution, contains changes that would repeal key parts of the Dodd-Frank bill put into place to rein in banks after the crises. The change would undo a measure in Dodd-Frank that prevented banks from taking risky gambles with publicly insured money. If passed with these provisions, the Cromnibus would allow banks to engage in some of the same risky behavior that helped cause the 2008 financial crisis. Senator Jeff Merkley and Senator Barney Franks, co-author of the Dodd-Frank bill, spoke out against the proposed changes.
I'm going to turn the clock back to where we were in 2007 and 2008. We had securities based on subprime mortgages. American Insurance Group, or AIG, was providing insurance called a swap on those securities. And eventually, the secured mortgages went bad because of the interest rates going up, and they were teaser rate mortgages. The securities went bad. AIG was overextended, and its insurance couldn't cover the securities, and our entire financial system melted down with great consequence to average Americans in terms of job losses, in terms of retirement savings, in terms of their prospects for the future and their ability to provide a foundation for their children's success. This is why we collectively said we must shut down the Wall Street casino, government-subsidized, high-risk trading in swaps. And that is what Section 716, the Lincoln provision, does. It says that if you're going to engage in this high-risk trading of these swaps, you can not do so in a manner that is subsidized by government insurance, and you cannot do so in a manner that places our entire financial system at risk. And what the provision does in the bill that we will have before us, that the House is entertaining, would be to say, no, let's keep that Wall Street casino alive and well. So I am strongly opposed to keeping the Wall Street casino alive and well. There is nothing wrong with using swaps, and we're talking about equity swaps and commodity swaps and credit swaps. There's nothing wrong with these instruments, but they should not be used with a government insurance standing behind them, and they should not be used inside an organization where, should those bets go bad, they place our financial system at risk. So I'm just going to stop right there and say I am clearly firmly on the side that this key provision in shutting down the Wall Street casino should not be reversed.
Thank you.
With that, I'll turn this over to, back to you.
No, go ahead. Sorry. Thank you, Senator. And over to you, Congressman.
Thank you. Ex-Congressman, I don't want anyone to start calling me up with constituency problems. I feel very strongly about this on several fronts. First of all, I agree with Senator Merkley. This provision is open to debate like any other. I remember we spent some time when it was originally put in by Senator Lincoln, and it was modified in conference with a lot of discussion, a lot of debate. Of course, it was adopted on the Senate floor. And I was skeptical about some of it originally. I believe the way we worked it out, it makes a lot of sense. But since that time, I think there's a consensus among a lot of people that part of the problem is the extreme complexity of some of these large banks. So it's not just a case of being at risk. There's a lot to be said for simplifying it. Even the well-managed banks, what we're told, have had trouble with their derivative book. So I think it is a great mistake to do this. Secondly, people have been working with this. You want some stability. Even people who didn't like this initially should, I think, accept the fact that it's been in the law for over 4 years now, and people are getting used to it. Some of the people in the financial community said, well, we don't like all this uncertainty. Well, the people supporting this amendment to the appropriations bills are the ones who are now putting back uncertainty. And then that's the last point, that it's in the appropriation bill. That is an absolute outrage. I am very proud of the fact that when we adopted these provisions in 2009 and 2010, it was in a very open process. We had many hearings in the House. We had many different markups. We had an open process for amendment on the floor. Senator Dodd was ready to entertain a lot of amendments. His Republican colleagues, and Senator Merkley remembers, decided at the last minute not to offer any. There were many amendments adopted on the floor. And then we had a conference on C-SPAN for 2 weeks in full public view. For the Senate now and the House of Order to go along to take a significant step towards removing one of the key provisions without any chance to debate it, without a chance to vote on it, with members being able to hide by voting for an overall bill, putting it in an appropriations bill that's a must-pass bill late in the session. It is the epitome of the wrong way to legislate, the outrageous way to legislate. And I want to stress this, what particularly troubles me is it doesn't just go to this particular provision. This is a roadmap for the stealth unwinding of financial reform. Opponents of financial reform understand that it's popular. They are too smart to make a direct frontal assault on it. But they have now apparently figured out the way they can do that. If they get away with this, we will have to worry that every time an important bill comes up that has to pass, you will see something like this, rolling back a provision that couldn't be passed on its own, couldn't sustain the need to be passed on a roll call vote, wouldn't have hearings, but would go through. So substantively and procedurally, this is a very real assault on the possibility of ensuring stability in our financial system.
That was Senator Barney Frank and Senator Jeff Merkley speaking out against the congressional plan to further deregulate the banking industry.
In Lima, Peru, delegates from around the world have gathered to negotiate an international response to climate change. This week's summit is part of the United Nations Conference of Parties. While the goal of the talks is to create a framework which will be approved in Paris next year, an alternative People's Climate Summit is also taking place in downtown Lima, and activists there have carried out their own activities, including a march today to demand a voice in the negotiations. Paul Rowland spoke today with KBOO reporter Yana Maximova, who is on site at the People's Climate Summit.
We're talking with Yana, a KBOO reporter, who is on the ground in Lima attending the COP, that's Conference of Parties, conference, the 20th round of climate talks sponsored by the United Nations, going on for how much longer is this going on for, Yana?
It's going to end this Friday, so you can actually feel the tension. Tension is building. And non-governmental organizations put a lot of pressure on. Well, they are putting pressure. At least they're raising awareness that the talks are, you know, the negotiations are just taking a long time and not yielding a positive result. So there is still some hope. Today is Wednesday. Talks going to end on Friday today. And yesterday,
those days are when we received presidents, like the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, spoke, addressed the plenary yesterday. Today we have the president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto. We have Russian delegation. We have a representative of the United States. We have big players addressing plenary. I'm not here to actually listen to it, but I'm going to follow it. And I guess one thing I wanted to point out, there is a way to listen, to actually live stream and stream look at the archive of all the talks that are happening. And it will require a little tweaking on the internet, but generally if you search for UNFCCC COP20 live stream, you will find the link. You'll find the website. You can watch all the talks, all the plenaries, negotiations. Unfortunately, not side events. So it is a good way to stay tuned. And
we're talking with Yana, a KABU reporter, who is on the ground in Lima attending the COP, that's Conference of Parties, conference, the 20th round of climate talks sponsored by the United Nations, going on for, how much longer is this going on for, Yana?
It's going to end this Friday, so you can actually feel the tension. Tension is building. And non-governmental organizations put a lot of pressure on, well, they are putting pressure, at least they're raising awareness that the talks are, you know, the negotiations are just taking a long time and not yielding a positive result. So there is still some hope. Today is Wednesday, talks going to end on Friday today, and yesterday there, those days are when we received presidents, like the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, spoke, addressed the plenary yesterday. Today we have the president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto. We have Russian delegation. We have a representative of the United States. We have big players addressing plenary. I'm not here to actually listen to it, but I'm going to follow it. And I guess one thing I wanted to point out, there is a way to listen, to actually live stream and stream look at the archive of all the talks that are happening. And it will require a little tweaking on the internet, but generally if you search for UNFCCC COP20 live stream, you will find the link. You'll find the website. You can watch all the talks, all the plenaries, negotiations. Unfortunately, not side events, but pretty much anything, even press conferences, which is actually incredible.
That was Paul Rowland
speaking twice with KABU's Yana Maximova at the People's Climate Summit in Lima, Peru. The full interview can be found at our website, kboo.fm.
An oil tanker in Bangladesh crashed into another vessel on Tuesday, spilling an estimated 75,000 gallons of oil into a rare dolphin sanctuary. The Bangladeshi Navy has sent 4 ships to try to deal with the incident. Officials said that the oil spill spread along a 25-mile section of the Sela River. Part of the river is a UNESCO World Heritage Site and a refuge for the rare Irrawaddy dolphin species. The government has filed a legal case against the owners of the 2 vessels. The 2 Navy ships that have already arrived at the scene are carrying chemicals to separate the oil from the water. Bangladeshi officials say they are uneasy about the situation because they haven't had much previous experience in oil spill cleanups.
The FBI has charged the former president of the company responsible for a massive chemical spill in West Virginia with fraud and lying under oath, according to a complaint released Monday. Gary Southern, former president of Freedom Industries, intentionally distanced himself from the company in order to deflect blame in the wake of the massive spill. In January, 10,000 gallons of hazardous waste was spilled into West Virginia's Elk River, contaminating the drinking water of nearly 300,000 people. Water in the Elk River ran black as coal and was infused with coal slurry for 6 miles. Soon after, Southern developed a scheme to protect his $8 million in assets, which involved misleading investigators about his knowledge of waste facilities. Southern faces criminal charges in the cover-up of the West Virginia chemical spill. Investigations into that spill are ongoing.
Thousands of protesters gathered in the political heart of Hong Kong last night for a final farewell to the pro-democracy camp that police warned would be demolished the next morning. This signals the end of the 10-week street occupations that have been part of demands for democratic elections for the city's leader. Attendance has waned at the protest camps since its September beginning, but thousands revisited the site to see it at a final time. One protester stood on a podium and told the crowd that while police could demolish their camp, it was impossible to take the desire for democracy away from them. Parts of the crowd packed away their tents quietly, while others said they would be willing to forcefully oppose any attempts to destroy the camp. Lately, protesters have been progressively divided between those who favor peaceful resistance and a minority who argue that escalating protests is the only way to get concessions. Police have already arrested 655 people since the protests began, and they say they expect more arrests during the teardown of the camp.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, December 10th, 2014. Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian official and settlers attack Palestinians on their way to war. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The head of the Palestinian